Tonight on Arena, Maggie O'Farrell brings us into the Shakespeare household in her new novel, Hamnet. And Phoebe Waller-Bridge brings the original Fleabag stage show online. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Hamnet is the title of Maggie O'Farrell's new novel. It's named after William Shakespeare's son, who died at the age of 11. 4 years after that loss, in 1600, in fact, Shakespeare composed one of his most famous plays and called it Hamlet. Hamnet, the novel, is about family ties, grief and mortality, all regular O'Farrell themes in fictions like This Must Be the Place and in the recent memoir I Am. And Maggie O'Farrell joins me now on the line from Edinburgh. And I suppose we should clarify, just for audio purposes, that the novel is spelled H-A-M-N for Noel, Hamnet, and the play is spelled H-A-M-L for letter, E-T, Maggie. But you point out at the very beginning of the book that, in fact, the names were interchangeable in Stratford in the 16th century.
That is quite right, yeah. So I'm spelling in Elizabethan times was obviously a lot less stable than it is now. So, in fact, the two names are completely interchangeable in parish records of the time. And Shakespeare himself actually had a very close friend called Hamlet Sadler, and he spells his name Hamlet in his will. So, obviously, the two. So, so it's very clear to me that he called perhaps his greatest tragedy after his dead son.
Mm. And was it a very common name, either Hamnet or Hamlet?
I don't think it was that common, actually. No, I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, his son and his daughter and the two twins were called after these two friends who were probably their godparents, Hamnet and Judith Sadler, who were the Bakers. But I don't think it was that common, no.
This is a novel, Maggie, that I think you've been trying to write for quite a while, in fact. What was it about Hamnet's story and the Shakespeare family at that time that interested you?
Well, it's funny. I had first heard about the existence of Hamnet the boy when I was studying for my Scottish Highers. So I was probably about 16 or 17, and we were studying the play Hamlet. And my teacher just mentioned in passing that Shakespeare had this son who died age 11, and he was called Hamnet. And it really struck me like a thunderbolt, because Shakespeare is a man who is so mysterious to us. You know, he's left, you know, for all his incredible output of work that we still have today, he left a very, very scant paper trail of himself. You know, there are very few clues about his life and the actual how he spent his days. And there are big sort of gaps and voids in his life story. But to me, this spoke enormous volumes. You know, to call your greatest tragedy and your greatest tragic hero after your dead son is telling us a huge amount about him and how he was grieving and how he felt for this poor lost boy.
And she was an unusual teacher, I would hazard a guess, because I don't think many people, certainly in my studying of Hamlet early on, that was never brought up and never mentioned to me. I don't think it's commonly, the two aren't commonly associated.
No, it's not. I mean, that was actually partly the reason why I wanted to write the book, because I felt really I was slightly sort of outraged by the sort of underwritten story of Hamnet the boy. You know, because I remember asking a few of my friends who'd studied literature like I did at university, saying, "Do you know what Shakespeare's kids were called?" And they all said, "No idea." And I said, "Well, his son was called Hamnet." And a lot of them said to me, "No, come on, you're making it up." And I said, "No, I promise you it's true." So I really felt as though history's kind of written out this boy somehow. I mean, the only other time I've ever seen it mentioned, he's mentioned in Ulysses, so James Joyce knew about him.
Yeah, and there was a short play done here in Ireland, which I think you may
That's
be aware
right,
of, Bush
the
Gate.
Yes.
That's right.
I haven't seen it. I actually avoided seeing it because I realised it was on the stage. But I would love to see it now. I would love to see it.
Yeah,
I finished the book. I'd love to go and see it.
Do you have to do that? If somebody else is treating a subject that you might be working on creatively, do you have to steer clear of other people's treatments?
Well, I think I did at that point because I thought, it's quite unusual, obviously, to be writing about this boy. And so I thought, the last thing I want is to get influenced by somebody else's ideas and somebody else's vision of it. You know, because everybody has their own relationship with Shakespeare. You know, he's soaked into our very language and the way we think about ourselves. So I just had to be careful to steer clear of it so I didn't get, it didn't become blurred in my head, I suppose.
The other thing, which is quite extraordinary, how ideas that are floating around a year or two ago suddenly have a relevance today that you couldn't have imagined back when you were writing the novel. Because Hamnet, the young boy, it would seem, died of plague, which was very prevalent in London and in England at that time.
Yeah, well, it's not actually known, to be fair to the real Hamlet Shakespeare, it's not actually known how he died. It is that there isn't any record of it in the parish book, but certainly, I mean, he died in a year where plague was, you know, there was a kind of outbreak of plague during that year. But the other thing that always fascinated me is that in all of Shakespeare's plays and poetry, you know, the metaphors he uses are so wide, you know, he reaches for such a huge number of subjects, but he never, ever, ever once mentions the pestilence, which they would have called it then, or what we now call the Black Death. There's no mention of it anywhere, which is pretty extraordinary, really, when you think how common it was and what a kind of ever-present threat it was to those people. You know, Shakespeare's career would have been repeatedly interrupted by the plague, because, you know, the first thing they did was close the playhouses. So, you know, he would have been forced out of London. He probably would have had to go on tour, or he would have gone home to Stratford-upon-Avon for months on end. So it's odd to me. It's always been a question in my mind as to why he never mentions it. And, you know, maybe there's a really heartbreaking reason for that. Maybe Hamlet did die of the plague.
Yeah, so that gives us a sense of the relationship between fact and fiction in the book. The Hamlet death is an invention of yours, but it has a possible... It's a probable that it could have happened.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely it happened. He died in August. I know he died, yeah. 1596, yeah, but we don't know why. But I suppose my interpretation of him dying of the Black Death was just kind of inspired by the lack of its mention in any of Shakespeare's work.
And, you know, if I was interviewing you at a different time, we would now move on quickly from that tiny little detail. But, of course, I mean, even as I was reading and I saw this scene where you described the doctor coming in wearing a mask, and you think, how suddenly things that were written, I presume, 18 months, maybe even 2 years ago, maybe further back in time, suddenly come into their own at the moment of reading.
Yeah, it is very odd. It's not something that I saw coming. If I'm honest, I am not Barack Obama, although I quite like to be. But you know, no, obviously, when I wrote it, you know, I wrote that there's a scene in it which it kind of traces the journey of the plague, and it comes via a flea of a monkey from Alexandria, and it comes all the way on a ship, you know, up and then up to London and to Warwickshire. So obviously, when I wrote that chapter, it was, you know, it was just an act of research, or, you know, and a bit of imagination as well. You know, I had to plot the sort of the route that all these trade ships would have come. But, you know, now I find myself looking at these infographics of these big sweeps and arrows of infections, and they look just the same as these Elizabethan routes for the plague. You know, it is extraordinary. And, you know, I think that the outbreaks of the Black Death, you know, were so enormous, and they killed, you know, a third of the world's population at times. You know, I think it really does form the kind of bedrock of our relationship with infection and contagion. I think we reach for those images, you know, even now when we're all struggling with this new pandemic.
We started by, you know, talking about the difference in the name Hamlet and Hamlet. Little did I know, for years I thought that Shakespeare was married to Anne Hathaway. It would seem not. He was married to Agnes Hathaway.
Yeah, well, one of the most interesting things I discovered when I was researching the book is that a year before Agnes and William get married, her father dies, and he mentions in his will that his dowry for his daughter, and he says, "My daughter, Agnes," or Agnes, as it would have been pronounced then. And I was absolutely flabbergasted by this, because I thought, you know, have we been calling her by the wrong name for 400 years? And, you know, obviously, again, you know, the spelling, the Elizabethan spelling, was unstable, so it's quite easy to see how Annis, something pronounced Annis, could be written as Anne. But, you know, I mean, if anyone knows her proper name, you'd think it would be her dad.
Well, exactly. You would have thought he would have a fair notion of it, right enough. But the other side of it is, if we're calling her by the wrong name, have we been telling other little porky pies about her along the way as well?
Well, I think so, because the other thing that really shocked me, actually, when I was writing the book, because I first sort of conceived it as a book about fathers and sons, as of course the play is, but I became really, really outraged, actually, on her behalf, because I found, you know, I was reading these big biographies of Shakespeare, and I mean, there's so much sort of criticism and hatred and hostility towards her. It's really peculiar. You know, people are so quick to assume that she trapped him into marriage, that she was a peasant, that she was uneducated, and that he hated her. You know, people are so keen to kind of retrospectively give him a divorce and say that, you know, that's the reason why he went to London, to get away from her. I mean, it's astonishing what people have read into the very, very tiny number of facts that's actually known about her. And I don't think it's true. I mean, yes, I think he probably had a whole other life, shall we say, in London. But, you know, at the end of his career, when he retired, he went back to Stratford to live with her. And that's not the action of a man who hated his wife. And every single penny he earned in London, he sent back to Stratford. He lived in really kind of very sort of very modest lodgings in London. But by the time he retired, he was equivalent of a multimillionaire. But all the money he sent back to Stratford, he bought houses, he invested in cottages, he was a huge landowner in Stratford. And again, that doesn't strike me as somebody who hates his family and regrets his marriage.
Yeah, but don't we get maybe this is apocryphal that I've just picked up along the way. Isn't it the will from Shakespeare to Anne Hathaway? She just gets the bed?
Well, that's right. But you see, I mean, his will is quite a strange document. It's very, very dry, and it doesn't show any of the affection and imagination and trick with, you know, his skill with words that he shows everywhere. And actually, the thing about the second best bed, it's what's called an interlineation. It's something that's added at the end, and it's squeezed in between two lines. And actually, there's no evidence of any affection for anybody that he shows. And I mean, he leaves his sister his clothes. You know, he leaves Judith, his daughter, a silver bowl. I mean, there's a complete absence of any sort of affection in any of it. So I don't think, and also, some people have said that the second best bed would have been their marriage bed. You know, the best bed was kept for visitors downstairs in the parlour. So there is an argument that actually he was giving it to her as a memento of their married love.
Yeah, but you do quite early on, because we go back to Agnes's, or Anne Hathaway's, childhood, and it was a difficult childhood, I think it's fair to say. She lost a parent quite early on. She lost her mother quite early on, and the stepmother wasn't that enamoured of Agnes and her other siblings from the first marriage. But you use the phrase at one point that Agnes had a bit of a reputation.
Yeah.
And that reputation had to do with her sexual activity. She would have been much older than William Shakespeare.
Yes, she was 26 when he married, and he was 18. She was also pregnant when they married, yeah.
And does she suffer again from this reputation that is put upon her, or do you think there is evidence, you know, that perhaps she was active with other men in the village?
I mean, there's no evidence at all of either, actually. I mean, it's possible that the baby wasn't his, but it's equally possible that it was. You know, I mean, they had to get a special license to get married because he was young. But I mean, it wasn't unusual for a woman of 26 to get married. But it's interesting, Germaine Greer has written a fantastic book about her called Shakespeare's Wife. And in it, she says, you know, scholars have always sort of begged, why did he marry her? You know, why did he marry this older woman? But she says we should all be asking the question, why did she marry him? Because because she's the one who has this quite stable home life. You know, her father was a well-to-do yeoman. He had this kind of very successful sheep farming land. And, you know, she was of age. But he was actually, I mean, he was penniless at the time, presumably, and he was tradeless. He was 18. His dad had been a high alderman, kind of equivalent of a mayor in Stratford. He'd been a very high standing. But his family had fallen on hard times. His father had started illegally wool trading. He'd been fined many times for different kinds of behaviour. You know, he'd had a huge fall from grace. And so the Shakespeares were actually at a sort of very low ebb of their fortunes. So I think Germaine Greer has a real point. You know, why did she marry him? And in my book, you know, I try to imagine what she might have seen in him. You know, what an 18-year-old Shakespeare would have been like in rural Warwickshire. Can you imagine how extraordinary he would have been? I mean, imagine being his teacher at grammar school, you know. I mean, his mind and his genius didn't come from nowhere. He must have been extraordinary even at 18. So I suppose I kind of took the novelist's option of making up, and I was thinking, well, maybe she saw something extraordinary in him that nobody else saw. Maybe she married him.
And also, given what you said about the marriage bed being the second best bed in the will, there may also have been the possibility that there was some love between the two of them.
Well, I think there was, actually. I mean, certainly, you know, I think it's safe to say that Shakespeare was a sexual being. You can certainly see that in his plays. And, you know, there are instances of very, very, very faithful and loving wives in his plays. That recurs again and again, and slightly errant husbands, you know, I have to say. So I think he did love her. I think, you know, obviously I think it was an unusual marriage, but, you know, looking back on it 400 years ago, it's very difficult for us to imagine what it would have been like. And it certainly wasn't unusual for husbands in Stratford to have to go to London to find work. You know, there are lots of instances of that in the records of the time. So who knows? I mean, it is a mystery.
Even as you speak, though, Maggie, I can hear, you know, when you talk about Shakespeare, can you imagine being his teacher in grammar school or in secondary school and saying, you know, you need to rethink that plot, William. It's not great. You might have another look at that scene that you're writing. Yeah. But for you then as the novelist to come and put words into the mouth of William Shakespeare, you know, to give him the ordinary things of life, getting up in the morning and doing the ordinary things around the house that one might do. How difficult was that? Was that daunting?
Well, yes, in a word, yes. I mean, obviously, you know, this is a book I wanted to write for a long time, and I actually tried to write it two or three times, and then each time I swerved away and wrote a different book. I did that, and that happened three times. I mean, it was partly because I was a bit nervous about writing about the death of a boy, while my son hadn't actually gone past the age of 11. It was all that I couldn't write it until my own boy was well past that age, because I thought I'm going to have to imagine what that was like. But also, you know, and I was put off, you know, because it is ridiculously daunting and seems terribly presumptuous to write about him, you know, on whose shoulders we all stand. But actually, the way I got around this, Parley, was that I don't use his name, so the name Shakespeare doesn't appear in the book, and the name William doesn't appear in the book anywhere. And I, you know, because I just, you know, like you say, I'd be sitting at my computer and I'd be writing, you know, I'd want to write, William Shakespeare came downstairs and had porridge for breakfast. And you know, you can't write that without immediately being pulled back thinking, I'm a total idiot, you know, what on earth do I think I'm doing? And then you kind of try William and you think, no, that's really presumptuous. And Will, I mean, you think, no, how can I possibly... So in the end, I just thought, no, I'm just going to leave his name out of it. But I think it was partly, you know, I think with this book, what I was trying to do is to get readers or ask readers to think again, you know, to think and to kind of forget everything they think they know about him and his wife and his children and actually open themselves up to a new story. Because obviously, you know, Shakespeare's story is filled with so many huge voids and so many things we don't know. But actually, for a novelist, that's kind of a gift, because you can just rush in and fill those voids with whatever it is, you know, you see, your own vision.
Could you see it, the novel being dramatised? Can you even think in those terms again, given that Shakespeare's involved?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the film and TV rights have been sold to a production company called Hero Productions, and they have their own vision, and they're quite excited about it, and they can see it broken up into so many parts or so many, you know, hours of TV or film or whatever. So it is quite exciting. But they said, do you want to write the script? And I said, absolutely 100% not. You know, I'm quite happy to hand it on to somebody who knows what they're doing in that department. But, you know, it'll be interesting. It'll certainly be fun if it happens.
Yeah, and like you, I'm interested just simply to know, how does William Shakespeare ask for some milk for his porridge, for example? Does he speak in iambic pentameter as he does it?
I wonder. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
Listen, you clearly, it has been something you've wanted to do for a long time, and you have done it now. What's the current project now that Hamlet is out and up and out, as it were, Maggie?
Well, it's funny. I've got a children's book that's coming out later in the year, which has been really fun. It was my daughter actually looking over my shoulder one day, and she was reading a bit of Hamlet, and she said, I don't like the story, it's too sad. You need to write a happy story next. So I did. I've written a kid's book, and so I'm just putting the finishing touches to that, and that's coming out in just before Christmas.
Yeah, and Hamlet certainly is sad. There'll be a few tears if you're reading it. Be warned.
a few.
That's Maggie O'Farrell speaking to me about her latest publication, Hamlet, which is published by Tinder Press. Alexandra, the name of that song there from Laura Marling, and that is from her latest album, Song for Our Daughter, which we reviewed on Friday night's programme. The fans of Fleabag, the television series, may have thought that when the series ended in spring of last year, we were saying a final goodbye to Phoebe Waller-Bridge's fine comic creation. But last summer, in London's West End, she revived the stage show on which the television series is based. Right now, on Soho Theatre's website, you can watch a recording of that performance online for a small fee. I think it cost me £4 to do it earlier on today, and there are various levels that you can pay. Proceeds from the screening are going to charity. But it's a big week for Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Her new comedy series Run premiered on HBO in the United States on Sunday, and it'll be on Sky Comedy on this side of the ocean tomorrow. And tonight then, the third season of the hit crime series that she was part of creating, Killing Eve, starts on RTE1 television at 10:15. So Phoebe Waller-Bridge certainly is everywhere. Mary McGill has been taking a close look at the Fleabag stage show, which kind of started it all off, Mary, I suppose, for Phoebe Waller-Bridge, because it was first, I think, 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago, that it was first on stage. Remind us about that character, Fleabag, Mary.
Yes, Fleabag in name, Sean, and Fleabag in nature. So it was Edinburgh Fringe in 2013 where Waller-Bridge introduced us to who has become kind of her calling card, this young woman called Fleabag, who is a kind of archetype now for a kind of a freewheeling, sexually liberated, but deeply unhappy and often very angry middle-class young woman, particularly British young woman. And this Fleabag character, and indeed her director at that time, Vicky Jones, who she has since gone on to collaborate, and you just mentioned Run there, who's also created by Vicky Jones. So they really created something that caused a stir at the Edinburgh Fringe that year. Fleabag the play was very much critically acclaimed, and as so often is the case when you create a stir at Edinburgh Fringe, the BBC, bigger production company, came calling, and a couple of years later we got the first series of what has since become, I think it is fair to say, I don't think it's hyperbolic to say that it has become a cultural phenomenon. And it's interesting to watch the stage play, because you can actually hear it in the crowd. Like, these are fans. These people know this character, and they're here to basically fawn over her, which is quite interesting, because the stage show, in comparison to the television, is very much its own beast.
Yeah, in fact, looking at it today, and this is not necessarily a criticism, it's quite a traditional piece of theatre in many ways. Excuse me.
It is. I think that's...
It's one woman sitting on a chair telling her story.
It is. It's very traditional. If you have done a monologue in drama class or studied the form for junior cert, you will, immediately recognise this. It is, as you say, very straightforward. We get some sound effects that are used, very well, very creatively. But fundamentally, it's a monologue. I mean, I think drama students, female drama students will probably be using it a lot in years to come and will be grateful for the material. But it's not exactly groundbreaking, whereas I think it is fair to say that the comedy has become recognised quite rightly as in a televisual sense, very groundbreaking.
But was there something, in form, it's quite straightforward, a monologue, an actor sitting on a chair delivering it straight to the audience. But in what would the content here, was there something very different there that perhaps women of Phoebe Waller-Bridge's age and generation just weren't seeing or hearing being done anywhere else at that time?
Yes, I think that's very fair to say. I think looking at the show now in 2020 is a reminder of how different the landscape was in 2013 when this play came out and this character it was so confronting. This is a young woman talking very bluntly and very darkly and quite in the raw about sex. And we, there's this notion, around sex positivity as having sex being liberating for women and a thing that for so long had been denied to them, the kind of freedom that men had in that regard. And now women are embracing their sexuality. And Fleabag, and we really see this, I think, in the play, perhaps more so than the TV show. She certainly embraces those freedoms, but I'm not sure, Sean, that they're bringing her a whole lot of happiness. And I think it's important to say with the stage show, it doesn't encompass the second series of the television show.
Yes,
so this is very much focused on the Fleabag as we meet her first. And that is, we do not get the same arc that we do with the television show. And I think that's quite interesting to see this character really at their lowest ebb and not necessarily transcended by the time the stage show ends.
Yeah, because she's dealing with, and fans of the, we're not giving anything away in terms of the television series, she's dealing with the death by suicide of a close friend, or possibly accidental suicide, if that's the right term to use. But whether she meant to take her own life or not is a moot point, I think, throughout both the series and the play. But she's very confrontational, really, in how she describes her sexual life and her use of pornography and all the rest. In fact, if we listen to a clip, we'll get a sense of that. This is, she has a long-term on-off boyfriend called Harry. And at this point in the stage show, she's describing what happens when herself and Harry are on one of their breaks.
Harry and I break up every 12 to 18 months, and when we do, well... I wish I could tell you my threesome story was awkward and sticky and everyone went home a little bit sad and empty, but it was lovely. Sorry. I do admire how much Harry commits to our breakups. The fridge is a new detail, but he does always go the extra mile. A few times, he's even cleaned the whole flat. Like it's a crime scene. I've often considered timing our breakups when the flat needs a bit of a going over, but I never know what's going to set him off. Keeps me on my toes. I sit on the loo. Think about all the people I can have sex with now. I'm not obsessed with sex. I just can't stop thinking about it. The performance of it. The awkwardness of it. The drama of it. The moment you realize someone wants your body. Not so much the feeling of it. I reckon I got about a week before Harry gets back, so better get on it. Into the shower, boom, bedroom makeup, boom, gonna really make an effort. I take half an hour trying to look nice, and I end up looking amazing. I mean, just best in ages, one of those days, boom, God.
And there we have Phoebe Waller-Bridge in a scene there from the stage show of Fleabag. And I should say, by the way, I caught myself swallowing. That's what had me coughing there, in case I've caused people discomfort. So I've had a large drink of water now and I'm feeling much, much clearer of throat. But Mary McGill speaking to us about Phoebe Waller-Bridge in general, but specifically this stage version of the Fleabag. So we get a sense of it there, Mary, just in the middle. You know, it's all laugh, ha, 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 funny, funny, jokes about threesomes, jokes about this, jokes about that. Then she goes into that serious tone. She drops it, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
She slows right down. I don't think that Fleabag, the character, ever would speak that slowly in the television series, or perhaps even that, you know, that seriously.
Indeed. Absolutely, Sean. I mean, the way she talks about sex and particularly pornography in the stage production actually, to my mind, skirts much darker territory in terms of even addiction and self-abuse. Like, she is not necessarily, she's playing for laughs there, which Fleabag is so good at. But as she says in the stage show, and I think this is quite fundamental, she talks about her addiction to needing attention. We heard it there in reference to her body. But somebody wanting your body is not the same as them wanting you. And she knows this. She's self-aware enough to know this, but she is stuck in this cycle of absolutely self-destructive behavior when it comes to sex. And again, because we don't get in the stage show the same kind of redemption that we see in series three of the television show, we are left as an audience with, you know, we get the laughs, you know, with Fleabag, of course we do. We get the awkwardness that is so celebrated, and quite rightly, but there's a much, much darker raw edge to the stage show. And I think it's really interesting as well to look at that as the origins of this character, and then to see over the trajectory of, you know, these years and its switch to television, the way Waller-Bridge has developed her. And indeed on stage we don't have the magnificent cast that we do on screen. They can't be developed in the same way, and of course that gives Fleabag on screen something to play against in a way this character, this lone character on screen, just can't, or on stage I should say, just can't.
And I suppose there are some voiceovers, disembodied voices from almost, you know, at the back of the theatre type of thing, as if they're speaking to her on a loudspeaker. That's the only other interactions we get. But what you've just said about the other members of cast gives us a very good reason to listen to Andrew Scott as the hot priest. And in the midst of this clip, if I remembered right from the television series, something falls at the back. You'll hear the clatter at a very specific moment in the dialogue. So let's have a listen to Andrew Scott and Phoebe Waller-Bridge from the television series Fleabag.
So you're a cool priest, are you?
A cool priest?
Yeah.
No, I'm a big reader with no friends. Are you a cool person?
Oh, I'm a pretty normal person.
A normal person?
Yeah, a normal person.
What makes you a normal person?
Well, I don't believe in God.
I love it when he does that.
That's Andrew Scott loving it when he does that. Yes. Obviously something falls at the back of it. I think it was a picture fail or something when she says, yes, I don't believe in God, Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Yeah. And they are very different beasts, really, Mary McGill, the television series and the stage play.
Absolutely. But I mean, what a great clip to play, because, you know, we get the sense of the hot priest there. But Sean, has there ever been a better metaphor than a hot priest to tell the audience that this is someone who is addicted to people who are emotionally unavailable, people who she can't have, people who, you know, Fleabag chasing these people is ultimately only going to end up hurting herself. And the hot priest really, in the second series, the final series of the television show, becomes a device through which Fleabag learns to understand and accept herself. We, again, to go back to the stage show, there's no hot priest, sorry, spoiler. But she doesn't have, she does learn something about herself. There's certainly a story and everything to it, but we don't get the same satisfaction, I think, as fans of Fleabag as a character who are rooting for her do at the end of the TV show. But yes, as we heard in that clip, God was not happy with Miss Miss Fleabag.
With
her disbelief. But you know what? She does a lot to offend God on stage and on screen. God bless her.
Although I wonder if there's a second stage show post the television series, if you like, Fleabag looks back, or Fleabag 5 or 10 years hence can look back on her life. But that's for another night and another programme, possibly.
I'd love to see it, Sean. I'd love to see that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you heard it here first. Let's talk about her other series, Run, which she produced and written again, as you mentioned, with her longtime creative partner, Vicky Jones. What's it about? I think you've seen one episode of this, Mary, have you?
I literally scoffed it shortly before we came on air. I really enjoyed it in true Waller-Bridge fashion. And I remember having the same feeling when I watched the first episode of Killing Eve a couple of years ago. Mm. I was like, I must see the next one. I must see it immediately. We have Donal Gleeson, our own Donal Gleeson, as Billy, who seems to be kind of like a Tony Robinson, you know, lifestyle guru type person. And we have Merritt Weaver, who people will probably remember from Netflix's big hit last year, Unbelievable. She played one of the detectives with Toni Collette. Really excellent performance. She plays Ruby. And the premise basically is that these two people are running away from their lives together towards what we're not too sure. But the chemistry, Sean, between Donal and Merritt it had me hooked right from the get-go. And Phoebe Waller-Bridge does chemistry so well. I mean, we see that with Killing Eve, you know, Eve and Villanelle, so drawn to each other, this cat and mouse game. It's not quite the same vibe here, but there's definitely a tension that that I immediately wanted to know more about. And I mean, again, her work ethic. I mean, this is incredible. She basically has a debut series coming out in HBO this week, third series of Killing Eve coming out on BBC. The Bond film that's been postponed, she was working on that script. And of course, we have the stage show now being, you know, launched on video streaming to support the arts and to support the effort against coronavirus. She is pretty formidable all round, I think it's fair to say, when it comes to the caliber of her work and the number of projects that, you know, she has on the go. It really is something.
All right. So you'll be glued to the telly then tonight for series 3 of Killing Eve, or have you already seen that?
No, I'll be tuning in to that, and I'll be checking out more of Run. So it's going to be a Phoebe Waller-Bridge feast for me this evening.
Yeah, and you can get the stage show, as I said, if you go to the Soho Theatre. If you just put in Soho Theatre Fleabag, it will come up, and you register on your account and you pay whatever you can, and then they will, you have access to it. I think for £4 sterling, you get access to it for 48 hours. So that's reasonable enough. You can pay larger amounts and get extras as well, if you want. But let's finish up by listening to a clip from Phoebe Waller-Bridge's latest creation, which is Run. Donal Gleeson and Merritt Weaver, as Mary McGill was telling us there. And here they are at the beginning of their running away.
I have nothing with me.
Just in that moment you just left?
Yeah.
So did I. You know, it's been 15 years.
Yeah.
You remembered everything.
First train after 5. I was sure you wouldn't be there.
I was there.
All handsome. This is unforgivable.
I know. Really? People forgive all sorts, don't they?
Not this. Who does this? Oh my God. What will I say?
To who?
make a rule?
Yeah.
So until tomorrow, can we have a moratorium on personal questions?
Okay.
You know, a moratorium. Do you remember that phase you had at college where you thought that the word hirsute meant the same as therefore?
Yeah, all right.
And you went around baffling people, hirsute. We should probably conclude, blah, blah.
All right, yeah, what's a moratorium?
It's a prohibition.
Oh, no.
No, that's not what it means, or no, you won't do
no,
that?
I won't do that.
Why not?
Because where's the fun?
Oh, you want fun?
Yeah.
You don't have to play. Hirsute. Who's Fiona?
Fine, let's do a moratorium.
There we go. So we have Killing Eve tonight on RTE Television. We have Fleabag available online, and the piece you just heard there, Donal Gleeson and Merritt Weaver in Run, available on Sky Comedy from tomorrow. Bedlam Suitcase is the intriguing name of a musical collective which came together following a David Bowie tribute night in Sligo in 2016. The collective was formed around three principal members, Padraig Meehan, Tara Bue Mooney and Tom Jimson. And between them, they have enlisted the talents of a further group of premier players in the areas of classical jazz and contemporary music. The new album from Bedlam Suitcase is called The Fourth Wall. It was launched in mid-February, just before the shutters came down on so much of the music scene in Ireland. I'll speak to the founding members, Padraig Meehan and Tara Bue Mooney, in a moment. But first, let's have a sample from the album. This is a track called Mountain Shadow.
In the shadow of a great mountain.
There we go, Mountain Shadow, the title of that track from The Fourth Wall, the debut album from the Bedlam Suitcase. And Padraig Meehan and Tara Bue Mooney, two of the founding members of Bedlam Suitcase, join me now. We might find out what the great mountain that we're speaking about there is. I don't know whose the lyrics are. Are they yours, Tara, or are they yours, Padraig?
Tara.
Well, Mountain Shadow is mostly my lyrics. Padraig and I often send lyrics back and forth, but Mountain Shadow happens to be about a story set against the backdrop of Ben Bulben, actually, in Sligo, the big plateau mountain. Mm. I don't know if you know it.
Oh, yes, it's a very magical mountain.
It's a magical mountain, yeah. So it's kind of a story within a story, that song. It's the death of a love story under the canopy of the forest being deforested. So it's kind of double destruction going on.
And your voice, I presume, are we hearing singing there, Tara Bue? Were there others involved with you in that recording, or did you do the harmonies yourself and then overlap them?
Well, I did the harmonies myself. They tend to kind of come out quite naturally. We have on some of the other tracks on the album, we have Nicola McEvely and Barry Brennan doing some harmonies, and Luke Devaney. But mostly I would kind of come up with a lot of those.
Going to you then, Padraig. I mentioned the fact that it was a David Bowie tribute night in Sligo in 2016. Mm. That was the kind of the beginnings of this group. So obviously, given the song we've just heard, Sligo's a big part of all of this. Just tell me what happened on that night. Were you paying tribute to Bowie when this idea came about, or what happened?
Well, there was a club called the Steampunk Club that I started in 2013 in the village I live in, Drumahaire, in Leitrim. And in 2016, after Bowie died, we decided, we had moved out, some of the events were movable. We'd do some in Sligo, some in other places. And we decided to pay tribute to Bowie. And in the course of publicising this and working on it, I became aware of Tara, who's also an admirer of Bowie.
And Tara, I've mentioned the Sligo connection, but the second part of your name there gives us perhaps that there's another part of the country that's very important to you. You might explain the derivation of that second part of your name, Bue.
Oh, yeah. It's from Killinian Boy, which is Kilnaboy. I'm from the Burren in County Clare. I grew up there. And my parents had a kind of a fascination for sacred and profanities, sacred profanities. So there's a Sheen and a Gig on that. It's a medieval church, or I think it's an 11th century church. There's a Sheen and a Gig on the door, and it means the Church of the Daughters of Bway. And Bway was a king in the Burren way back. So they gave me Bway. They gave me Tara Bway. Yeah.
Right. We maybe in a different piece of music, you might pitch the two landscapes against each other. I don't know if that's a good idea or not. Yeah. But Padraig, why are we talking about a music collective here rather than a band?
Well, because the steampunk club that from which it originated was an arts club that involved spoken word, that involved visual art. And in the course of making this piece of work, we're interpreting it in other ways. You know, the likes of Niall Henry from the Factory Theatre has directed a video with us. We have Mike Bunn, who was recently sadly bereaved, I should say. But Mike Bunn is a photographer. There are many different artists, fashion designers who've worked with Tara, and other people sort of. So it's not, although there's a core of us, there's an 8-piece live band, and beyond that, a whole community who we see as being part of the project.
And I guess that means, Tara Bway, that the, you know, that allows for that it's not going to be a very straightforward, here's the style of music and that's it. There's quite an experimental focus here.
Yeah, definitely. I think it questions more than it answers, to be honest with you, because we're all questioning. We've done a lot of things and we've been around as artists in different capacities, and I think, you know, we've all observed a lot, and we're just really placing our observations together. It's very experimental, but it's also been really rewarding. It's not an easy listen.
Yes, but it does pay rewards if you do listen. Well, let's have a listen to another little piece, actually. I'm wondering who you're questioning here, although I think it's fairly straightforward, as we listen to the lyrics of this song, Meet the Media. There you go. Meet the Media, the title of the song from Bedlam Suitcase and their debut album, The Fourth Wall, Padraig Meehan and Tara Bway Mooney of The Collective speaking with me now. Meet the Media, Seedier and Greedier. I should say good night and thank you very much at this point. was in the mind there, Tara?
It's not really to be taken literally. I mean, all of the songs kind of are ideas in imaginative spaces, and that song really just plays with the idea of deception and truth, and maybe using deception to push an idea or an agenda. Truth can be constructed out of deception, can be constructed out of anything, and everything's relative to the viewer and the views.
and in your case then, Padraig, obviously... Tara has said it herself, you know, you really have to work when you're listening to this, and we get a sense there of some of the, you know, the slightly more out there jazzier themes that are in some of the tracks as well. Was the idea with this particular production actually to allow yourselves to do just that, to experiment and not to worry too much about the commercial aspect of things?
Absolutely, that's very true, Sean. Before I go into that a little, I should say about Meet the Media as well, is that it's by no means targeted at the media. It's much more a song about people who are manipulating the media, and about, you know, there's another song called Hey Caligula that has the line in it, bring me the head of radio news. And we're very conscious, you know, of the number of journalists who've died in the course of their work in the last decade, and the pressures that have come on the media. So that's a song about constructed identity. That's not necessarily targeting the media, but those who are making use of the media in a very ugly way.
Mm. As you say, as the lyrics say, putting on your face to actually do whatever it is you're going to say on whatever platform you're saying it on. Who will introduce then the final track that I want to finish up by listening to, which is Bouncing Towards Bethlehem? Which of you has something to tell me on that?
We both do, probably. Porrick, you start.
You go first, Porrick.
Well, Bouncing to Bethlehem, I mean, one thing about the music that we admire and that I admire over the years is that it's not necessarily like singer-songwriters who write from the heart about their own experience. We've created characters here and we've cast them. And Tara, in another world, has been a voice actress. So she's inhabiting here another character. Now, this character has to do with colonialism. It has to do with a white colonial view of the world, and this is a little slightly ironic but light little tune to celebrate that.
And briefly from you, Tara?
Well, it was a really interesting song in terms of its process, because it literally fell out almost fully formed the very first time that the three of us got together to work on it. And in the live setting, it's kind of growing a little bit. So other things have started to be added to it.
Well, we listen to what you have at the moment, and you can continue to add in further versions as time goes on. That's Porrick Meehan there and Tara Buemuni of Bedlam Suitcase, and let's have a bit of Bouncing Towards Bethlehem. There we go. Bouncing to Bethlehem, the title of that track from The Fourth Wall, which is the new album from the music collective Bedlam Suitcase. And you can find out how to get your hands on the album on the Bedlam Suitcase Facebook page. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was the sound engineer this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Olin McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.